If you like what you hear on the Security Ledger podcast, you might want to check out one of our cybersecurity newsletters like the Daily Ledger or the Weekly Ledger. You can sign up for them at securityledger.com/subscribe. Hello, and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief and publisher of the Security Ledger. In this week's podcast, episode number 83, information on 12,000 YouTube stars, Instagram power users, and other online influencers was leaked. We'll talk to the guy who found the data trove and talk about how it got there. Also, websites that haven't made the cut over to secure HTTP will get a rude awakening come July when Google's Chrome browser starts labeling sites that don't use HTTPS insecure. We've got an expert from the certificate authority DigiCert in the studio to talk about how the transition to HTTPS is going and what sites that haven't made the cutover need to do between now and July. But first, the Winter Olympics kicked off last week in Pyeongchang, South Korea. And lo and behold, before the Olympic cauldron was even ignited in Pyeongchang, cyber attacks apparently took down connected television monitors and the game's wireless networks. Who's responsible for these attacks and what's their motive? To find out, we invited Raj Samani, McAfee's chief scientist, in to talk about research his firm has done on the malware used in recent attacks and what we know about who's behind attacks on the Olympics.
I'm Raj Samani, chief scientist and McAfee fellow. You know, this campaign began at the end of December. And to be honest, it was pretty good. I mean, okay, you can laugh and say, oh, well, you know, it was a traditional phishing scam. But actually, beyond the phishing scam, there was a lot about this attack which really was, you know, high degrees of obfuscation. And not only that, but, you know, the bad guys, what they did was they actually leveraged tools that the industry have developed. So I said this actually in, I think it was like end of October, where I said, look, criminal groups don't need 0 days. And even nation states don't need 0 days. They just need to follow the right people on Twitter. This particular attack is a really wonderful example whereby they use tools that the industry had only made available a few days earlier.
And by obfuscation, you're talking about that they really were able to cover their tracks within the malware, make it very hard for analysts like McAfee employees to understand how the malware works or what it does.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, when we published this, you know, we detailed the attack. And then I would say about a few weeks later, we found more about this particular attack, this specific campaign. In fact, what we were able to do was we were able to find details about the measures that were used to gain persistence on the compromised systems. So really what we've seen is we've seen kind of two publications about this. And each of those publications, I think, show a degree of capability, I think you could probably use the word, that actually is really impressive. And so, you know, it began obviously with an email. Now, the email itself was very, very highly targeted. But what I thought was interesting was they actually sent an email with a malicious Word document with the original file name, which basically said organized by Ministry of Agriculture and Forestry and Pyeongchang Winter Olympics .doc. Now, the email itself was actually sent to icehockey@pyeongchang2018.com. But the interesting part was there were multiple organizations that were on the BCC line. And, you know, the majority of these organizations were in some way, shape or form associated with the Olympics. Now, that was either infrastructure, tourism or some degree of supporting role. Now, I guess the first question you'd want to ask is, well, why would you have it in the BCC line? Why would you not just send it directly? And, you know, I think that was a social engineering ploy. The psychologist Caldini talks about social validation. In other words, there's safety in numbers. And I think perhaps, you know, it invoked, or perhaps they thought it would invoke subconscious behavior to open the document, which was, oh, you know, we didn't get this email. Maybe they sent it to me by mistake. Let me see what's actually happening. Because the email itself actually appeared to come from the NCTC, which is the National Counterterrorism Center. But it wasn't them. You know, when we look at the email, it was actually coming from Singapore. Right. And what was interesting was at the time, the NCTC were carrying out physical security drills related to counter-terror exercises. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was reconnaissance done.
Yeah, so there was a larger context here that folks who were involved in the Olympics in some way are going to be participating, right?
Exactly, yeah. So I think it was, what they want to do is, and actually, email is probably the most effective, or actually one of the most commonly used delivery mechanisms for malicious content. And so, by putting it on the BCC line, by looking to come from NCTC, they leverage authority as a principle, by sending it, I think it was 337 organizations on the BCC line. Of course, that then invoked for them to be able to open the email and the document. And, when they open the document, this is when we begin to see some relatively new techniques because, the first thing that you have is you get a security warning which says, please enable content. And then when they enable the content, this is when they begin to create obfuscation because the document had an obfuscated Visual Basic macro, which then launched a PowerShell script. We've been talking a lot about the rise of fileless attacks. And, here's a really wonderful example where fileless attacks are used. But this is where it starts to get even more interesting because at that point, the script actually downloads and reads an image file from a remote location. Within that, they're actually leveraging steganography, which I anticipate to be probably more prevalent, I think, for obfuscated attacks in the future. And so that actually, that PowerShell, there's a new PowerShell script within the file, and that then launches a new script.
And so then, steganography, this is when they are hiding the malicious code or the script within an image, within the data of an image. So to look at it, this would just look like a banner image on a website or something. But actually, when you download it, there's code in it that gets executed, right?
Yeah, well, and here's the cool part. So they actually used an open source tool called invoke-psimage. But here's the thing. That particular tool was actually released on the 20th of December.
Wow.
Within 8 days, they'd...
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right? Which is within 8 days, they had identified the tool, they tested it out, they made sure that it worked, and they weaponized it in 8 days.
Huh.
They actually used string-based obfuscation within the PowerShell script. And so, of course, that was another degree of obfuscation that they used. Now, at that point, we kind of said, oh, that's a great piece of research, and, we were quite successful in terms of, unraveling all of those multiple layers of obfuscation. So I was really proud of the team. And, it was a lot of work to kind of reveal that much. And what we did was there was a log server, and I think that was in Europe, in Eastern Europe. And that log server contained details of the connections back to the C2 infrastructure. And what we were able to do was by reviewing this log information, and actually the server had gone down by then, so we had access to the cached information. What we were able to do is we were able to say, well, okay, look, we can see connections coming in from South Korea. We know that actually there are some systems that have been compromised. And so, we don't obviously know what was taken, but what we do know for a fact is that some systems have been compromised.
The Olympic Games come along every 2 years. How often is it, in your experience, that there are cyber attacks directed at International Olympic Committee or the various national Olympic committees or companies and other groups that are affiliated with the Games? I mean, is this unprecedented or is this more or less business as usual in the 21st century?
Yeah, so it's a difficult, like I find myself, I mean, whenever I'm asked questions about attacks and campaigns, my default answer is I don't know. But the truth is that there's been a multitude of attacks against major events all across the planet, right? And that's kind of expected, and a lot of that's noise, right? It's things like port scan. Just to be clear, this is not one of those, millions of attacks that are kind of wrapped up in terms of a good PR statement. This is surreptitious. This is, this is a lot more hidden, and I don't recall of any campaigns that have been identified targeting any of the major events that had A, this degree of success, and B, this level of obfuscation. And and I guess in part that doesn't mean it didn't happen, it just means that it hadn't been identified before. And I don't want to quote Rumsfeld, but it's the unknown unknowns, right? Which is, we don't know what we don't know. The other thing to add about this particular campaign was that was obviously the first part of the research, because the second part of the research that we did, and we actually found, I would say, round about, I would say the 7th beyond, right? So beyond the 7th of January, was we were actually able to find the implants, and there were DLL implants that were used, and they were called Ghost 419, Brave Prince, and Gold Dragon. And you know, we didn't make up those names; they were actually hard coded into the implants, and that enabled the bad guys to maintain persistence on the infected systems. And so, you know, they were modifying DLL files; they were to maintain persistence. And again, you know, that shows a level of capability that I think goes beyond just, you know, the traditional kind of noise of malware and attacks that we see.
But often when the target is South Korea or organizations within South Korea, whether those are banks or civil society organizations, the list of suspects is short, and it generally is North Korea, their enemy to the north. Is that safe to assume in this case, or are there other possibilities? Does McAfee have any thoughts on what the motivation behind this attack may be and who may be behind it?
Yeah, so the game of attribution roulette is well underway. And, you know, in this particular instance, we kind of said, well, look, you know, we suspect it is, you know, nation state involvement. Unfortunately, I think, you know, as a society, we're far too quick to point the fingers. And there's always the risk that there's false flag operations. I mean, clearly here, you've got a threat actor that has Korean language skills. Now, you know, that kind of points to one direction, I guess you could say, but equally there is the risk that there are false flags, or it could be made to look like that. And so in this particular instance, what we said is, you know, nation state actor with Korean language skills. And does that mean, well, it's, you know, okay, that's, is that one entity? Well, you know, that's what it points to, but quite frankly, there's always the risk that there's another actor involved here. And we've got obviously a full degree of analysis about this particular attack, but I think some of the other ones that are being reported, it's still, I think, unclear as to, you know, is it the same threat actor, and, you know, was it the same tactics and techniques used, who was targeted, and what the purpose was. I mean, I think for this one, you know, we're fairly comfortable in the fact that we believe this to be an espionage campaign, and, you know, what exactly they took out and, you know, how successful, just exactly how successful they were, remains a little bit unclear at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting that just as we can read reports from McAfee and other vendors talking about targeted attacks and, you know, TTPs, right, tools, tactics, and procedures or processes, of course, nation state actors could read those reports too. And if they want to make an attack look at like a previous attack by a nation state, then they can do that.
Well, exactly. And I think, you know, this kind of shows the asymmetry about the amount of information available, because, you know, the bad guys can follow the right people on Twitter. They can read the blogs. They can attend the webcasts. They can download the proof of concept code, and they can even, you know, ask about and query questions and view things about roadmaps.
Yeah.
We don't have that luxury. We you know, it's the complete inverse.
Yes.
You know, they don't share with us any details at all.
Well, let me just say, if Fancy Bear does decide to start holding webinars, I will definitely register for them, as I'm sure you will.
Oh, do you know the funniest thing, though? So we did a campaign. So we tracked a campaign which was a geopolitical in nature. And what they were doing was they were compromising the Twitter accounts of high-profile politicians and media. So what they did was they compromised these accounts, and they were then using direct messages to compromise other accounts. And it was, you know, pretty significant, the level of access that they got. I mean, some of the accounts, you know, I think the combined followers was like in excess of millions of people. But the remarkable thing was they actually posted a video on YouTube where they were showing how they managed to get in. And not only how they managed to get in, but they were also inferring who their next targets were. And to be honest, I really appreciated that, because that was superb, because that actually gave us a full insight into how they got in, what they did, who they were going after next. And so I wish they were all like that, to be
honest.
Yeah,
exactly. More transparency all around.
Look, the most important thing you can do is you know, stay connected. We post on McAfee_labs. I'll post them on my own sort of social media feeds as well. And you know, what we do as part of every single piece of research is designed to try to make the place safer. So You know, we share all of our content, pre-release information with, you know, the various law enforcement agencies and impacted organizations. We do share this information with our commercial competitors. They're not really our competitors. They're friends and colleagues and peers in the industry. So we do share that beforehand. And most importantly, we share it with everybody here. So you've got access to the indicators of compromise. You can search within your environment to determine whether, you know, you were also impacted, for example, or whether you've had any communications with the C2 infrastructure and with the criminal infrastructure. And so that to me would be the kind of, you know, the one takeaway that I would say is, you know, be connected, get up to date with information. And if you have any questions, then, you know, my DMs are open. I won't click on links, obviously, but my DMs are open and, you know, happy to kind of point anybody to any of the content.
Raj Samani of McAfee, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity.
Up next, a few weeks ago, Chris Vickery of the firm UpGuard was warning about the leak of data on 123 million U.S. households from the firm Alteryx. This week, it was data on 12,000 online influencers, including YouTube stars and Instagram celebrities. Behind both incidents was a common culprit, insecure cloud storage containers hosted by Amazon.com. In our next segment, we invited Vickery into the Security Ledger studios to talk about how he found the latest trove from a firm called Octoly and what the discovery might mean for those affected.
This latest one, surprisingly enough, I didn't know who Octoly was. It wasn't like I was fuzzing the name Octoly or anything. Actually, I am progressively moving through dictionaries of prefixes and suffixes and throwing all sorts of weird crap into the scanning and crawling measures that I go through when I'm looking for exposed data. And what I had plugged in was literally the letters OCT, then wildcard.s3.amazon.aws.com. And when it hit on the letters OLY, lo and behold, there was an open bucket there. So it was literally at octoly.s3.amazonaws.com, which is, you know, the suffix domain area for Amazon S3s. There was no special name or anything. It was literally the company name was the bucket title.
So this is really a dictionary type approach when you're trying different combinations of letters and so on?
A bit of fuzzing, a bit of iterations, but yeah, mostly the heart and soul is just a dictionary that I go through that has, you know, millions and millions of entries in it.
Chris, was this data store a backup of their web application server or what? Why was the data there and discoverable in the first place?
It appeared to me to be like kind of a daily workhorse holding area. So yeah, it was being updated quite frequently and was in active use. And when I first stumbled across it, there was a large SQL backup file that was downloadable. Not all of the SQL backup files were downloadable, but one of the main ones was that I assume has just about everything they use to operate their services in it. And there were a bunch of Excel spreadsheets being held in there, and many of them with the title Creators, followed by strings of, you know, random hashes after it. And creators are who I believe are these internet celebrities. That's what they call their, you know, one half of the relationship, because they have the brands on one side. Those are the clients. Then they have the creators on the other that are the actual web celebrities. And there was PII, personally identifiable information, for over 12,000 of them, people with up to 6 million plus followers.
So these are people we might think of as influencers or folks with big social media followings, YouTube stars and things like that?
Instagram, YouTube. There's evidence that they reached into Twitch for a little bit. They all had categories or columns for people's Facebook and Pinterest accounts, as well as what emails tied to their PayPal, along with all the first name, last name, home address, phone numbers, secondary phone numbers, date of birth, all that stuff.
So, Chris, these influencers had registered with this service for Octoly, and in exchange, they get promotional swag from these companies. Is that basically the idea?
To the best of my understanding, yes. They get free promotional gear from the brands that are working with Octoly. And I guess the hope is that they'll review it honestly, and the brands are hoping they'll review it in a way that reflects well upon the brand and in front of a large group of people. There's also something to do with Octoly points or Okta points or something, and the fact that they had columns for PayPal accounts, it piques my interest and my curiosity as to whether or not they are simply paying people off as well. But I have no evidence to back up whether or not actual transmission of simple funds happened.
Chris, this could be the 21st century payola scan that you've discovered here.
There's nothing stopping somebody from turning around and selling these brands' free promotional stuff on eBay or something, I guess. I mean, anything you receive of value should be reported as income.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure they're reporting all this as income, Chris, to the IRS. No question about it.
Oh, yeah. I'm totally sure everybody's on the up and up.
So have you reached out to Octoly regarding this discovery? And could you talk about your interactions with the company, which is based in Paris?
So I had every reason to believe it was a legitimate data breach style data exposure scenario, because it was apparent that this is, you know, personally identifiable information. It didn't look like a fake. Everything lined up when I looked up some of these people as far as, you know, where they were registered from and other accounts that are under those names and everything. So I found it about 1 p.m. on January 4th. Within about an hour and a half, I had sent the initial notification email that I had, you know, found this, and it appeared to be something that needed to be addressed. Then on the 5th, I sent the Twitter message. On the 8th, I called the corporate headquarters. On the 12th, I called corporate headquarters again. I noticed that on the 12th, the large database backup file, the large SQL, had been removed from the repository, but all the spreadsheets were still there. So I don't know if that's in response to me reporting this and they just didn't get back to me, but removed the big database backup or what. We got an email from the founder on January 14th. I responded on the same day, got an email back from him on the 15th. I responded on the 15th. Then on the 19th, I followed up to make sure they were aware that these spreadsheets were still exposed, because it was concerning that all these people's information was still out there. Then on the 22nd, the founder responded back to me saying that they released a new version of the app that morning and these exports were now protected and that they will delete the past ones on that day. That was not true. And then on February 1st, I was able to confirm that the bucket had been secured from downloading.
So, Chris, what level of security was there for the bucket initially when you found this?
It was just wide open. At one point, it was actually only open to globally authenticated users, which means anybody with an AWS account. And then finally, it was locked down to where you couldn't download anything as of the 1st.
This global authenticated users, that's not a default setting, right? This is something that you have to enable as the S3 customer.
Yes. And a lot of people don't seem to understand what it means. It's very concerning that the confusion still seems to be out there. I mean, there's an explanation if you go into the Amazon documentation and read exactly what it is, but who's going to do that? People go by what something sounds like.
Okay, so a pretty similar setup here. Do you have any confidence that Octoly got the message?
Octoly was a little slow getting it secured, and they seem to be confused about quite a few things. And I don't know how you become such an influential player in that market and not have a grade A tech staff, you know, on board. But apparently, you know, from my interaction with them, they don't have a grade A IT staff running things. There were hashed passwords. I'm assuming they are the passwords that these 12,000 people log into Octoly with. But the odds are a decent percentage are reusing passwords from other places. Now, they did use a strong algorithm, Bcrypt, to protect these passwords. But if somebody had sufficient computing power and a high level enough target, which a lot of these people are, you know, there's a chance that, you know, some common passwords could be discovered.
Yeah, these people are really high value targets. I mean, they've got large social media followings. That would make them very attractive, right?
Exactly. So having the hash passwords is concerning. And then recently there were a couple of people killed in swatting accidents where, well, the swatting was done on purpose, but the police accidentally ended up shooting somebody. And for the Twitch gaming community and all, there's a decent number of them included in here. This would feed a swatter everything they need. They would give them the phone number they need to spoof. It would give them the app to So the target, it's everything you would need to do some really heinous stuff.
What strikes me is that we've got this 1099 economy that we're all living in, right? So there are just so many sites or small businesses operating online who you might be interacting with, and you're giving them information about yourself. It could be social security number, bank accounts, mm-hmm. passwords. So, I mean, it just occurs to me that you really need to be thinking about the security of the websites and infrastructure that those companies use, what they're going to be doing with the data you're giving them, how they're storing it and stuff like that, right?
And writing it into the contract as of how they maintain it. And then you need a way to verify that they're following that, which is tough these days.
So you talk about best practices for securing the cloud. Any takeaways from this?
Well, not to be too much of a shill, but as a result of so many companies coming towards UpGuard and asking, hey, can you check us to see if we're okay on our bucket stuff? We've actually started a high-level kind of white glove service that the highest level of enterprises can come to us and sign on as breach site clients, and I'll personally check out their web footprint and try to find all these buckets and everything. So there's going to be a more and more of a market for that type of thing, the companies that are going to be checking to make sure you haven't screwed up with a vendor somewhere.
How do you know if you found everything? I mean, you're casting nets and lots of stuff is showing up, but do you ever wonder, what am I missing or not looking for that's out there?
Oh, yeah. One of the constant battles that's in my head is when I do find something, okay, it's how long do I wait and try to find other things that this company may be screwing up with versus how long do I wait before notifying them of this problem? Because I'm certain once I notify them, they're going to lock down everything. And a large percentage of what they're exposing is just never going to be told. So I don't think we can ever find everything.
Last question, Chris. So GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, is coming up. That's an EU standard, and this Octoly is a French company. So with GDPR taking effect in a few months, this type of slip-up could get very expensive for companies like Octoly, right?
This is a good example of somebody who might have been subject to the, what is it, $100,000 a day fine for not securing a data breach. I mean, this went on for 26 days or something. That's a lot of money.
Chris Vickery, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much. Anytime, man.
And finally, there will be big changes to the web come July. That's when Google has said it will start playing hardball with websites that haven't yet made the transition to secure encrypted HTTP, otherwise known as HTTPS. Though it's been used by major websites for years, millions of others are still not compliant with the HTTPS standard and could be in for a rude awakening, says DigiCert Executive Vice President of Product, Jeremy Rowley. In this conversation, Jeremy and I talked about what firms that might have put off the HTTPS transition need to do to get ready and what awaits them if they don't.
Jeremy Rowley, Chief Product Officer. What we're talking about is security. So there's two ways of connecting to websites, right? You can do it securely, where the website is encrypted, where the information that's going to and from the website is encrypted, or you can do it unsecurely. HTTP is the unsecure mechanism for accessing a website, where HTTPS provides that encryption of the communication so that third parties can't listen in onto or read that communication that's going back and forth.
This is stuff that really we've known all along, but it started getting noticed, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago. I think there was like the FireSheep plugin, right, where you could just sort of snoop on people's web browsing sessions and so on. So this transition's been happening really ever since then. We've seen major sites like Facebook and Google and so on, Twitter, go to HTTPS. But, you know, there's a long tail online and on the web. So where are most companies with this? Have most websites made this transition?
A majority have. I think the last, I can't remember what the last Google numbers are, but I believe it's well over 50% at this point. But there are a lot of big sites that don't have it yet. For example, Alibaba doesn't, which is the giant Chinese reseller or product provider. I think Microsoft.com doesn't, and a few other large, significant sites don't. But I think the majority of websites now are being reported as having HTTPS enabled.
And what is the justification for not having done it yet?
I don't know. I'm not sure what the justification is. There's not a good reason not to have it enabled at this point in time, right? Yeah. We're in 2018 now. So probably cost and time, and as well as wanting to support perhaps really, really, really old browsers that may not do it. I don't know. I think all major browsers since the old Firefox, pre-Firefox days, you know, back when it was Netscape, they all support it now. So I'm not 100% sure what the rationale is for not deploying it.
For website operators, I mean, how complex is this transition to just begin using secure HTTP? They might think, oh, I've got to go out and obtain a certificate and register it and install it on my web servers. But what are we really talking about here?
That's what they do have to do that. So there is some work involved. You have to go and get a digital certificate and put it on the server. But with all of the automation that's come around in the last couple of years, it's easier than ever to download a certificate, order it, install it, and get it all configured. Plus, every CA essentially, almost every CA is willing to provide you complete support and helping making sure that happens. You know, there's been strong incentives to do HTTPS for a while. With Google, Google started a while ago. Giving you a lower rating on your search results if you didn't have HTTPS. And so this is just part of that push, that additional push to make it happen.
And what Google has said is that the Chrome browser is going to start labeling any site or web page that uses HTTP, in other words, non-encrypted HTTP, as not secure. What will that look like for users? What will the user experience be? And I guess what would that mean overall for the site?
So Google's already been doing this with some sites, right? They've been doing it kind of in a batch process. But in June, it's going to be all sites out there that don't have HTTPS. And what you'll see is on the address bar of your browser where you see, normally you see what website you've gone to, you'll see a not secure next to it. I imagine they've talked also about adding color coding and things like that later on. But right now it's just like a black lettering that says not secure. And for sites with HTTPS, you'll see the green word secure.
Right. And as you said, the consequence is more than just kind of bad optics up there in the URL field. It's also potentially could affect how your content, website content, is treated by the Google crawler, the Google bot, and other search engines. Is that right?
That's right. You get a lower search ranking. You get all kinds of penalties. And I think there's been some reports lately that HTTPS is actually faster now than HTTP. There's not really a good reason not to use it. A, you get the better search results. B, you get the better optics. And C, it's just as fast. So I would encourage everybody to deploy it if you haven't already.
Okay, and do we know what other browsers are going to do? I mean, often Chrome and Google are out in front. Any word on Firefox, you know, Microsoft's browsers, Bull, Safari, and so on?
No word yet, but I imagine that they'll follow suit shortly.
Okay. So you work for a CA. What's your advice? You know, if people are panicking or deer in the headlights effect with this, how do they get started?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to get started. All you need for the word secure to appear is a DV cert, which is great for low-value transactions. And when I say DV cert, it's a low-cost or free certificate that basically doesn't have any identity related to it. All it does is encrypt the website communication. You can go and get one of those from DigiCert or from another provider and get it installed and going right away. You know, the sign-up process is a couple of clicks. You basically have to enter your domain name and provide a CSR so that we know you which public key to affiliate or to put in the certificate. Then we do some initial vetting to make sure you actually own the website. After that, we issue the certificate and you're away you go. It can be issued in a matter of minutes. This has been a long time coming. I mean, you've seen lots of pushes over the last years. You had Always On SSL, which was a big push. You've had Google pushing it for a while. You've had CAs pushing it forever, of course, because that's what we do. I think this is just one more step in that direction. And I think you'll see additional steps as that come out as people either migrate or don't migrate, because we really want to secure the web, right? We really need to secure the web because the number of attacks, the man-in-the-middle attacks, they're ongoing. People's credit card information gets compromised all the time. So protecting this kind of information or protecting the integrity of the online transaction systems and the online communication is of paramount importance in making sure we have a secure internet going forward.
Hey, Jeremy Rowley of DigiCert, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Hey, thanks, Paul. I appreciate it.